Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. A big break in a New Hampshire cold case known as the Bear Brook murders. A judge rules that the state is underfunding its public schools, and former vice president and current 2020 presidential candidate Joe Biden swings through New Hampshire talking up his climate change policy. These and other stories made headlines this week. We're going to talk about them in this hour. And we're also broadcasting a live video of this radio show, and you can watch it at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. So this week, after so many decades of wondering, authorities have revealed the identities of three of the four people killed in the so-called Bear Brook murders. Before we get to our panel of esteemed journalists and analysts, I want to kick off the show today talking about this case. Four bodies were found inside barrels near Bear Brook State Park in Allenstown, and through the use of genetic genealogy, investigators were able to identify the killer. And now, Jeff Strelzin, Associate Attorney General, announces the identities of three of the four murder victims.
Based on information from the woman's family and the work of a researcher, as well as DNA testing and genealogical research, we've identified three of the Allenstown murder victims. Specifically, we've identified the victims we've referred to over the years as the mother, the oldest child, and the youngest child. And here they are. The mother has been identified as Marlise Elizabeth Honeychurch.
NHPR's Jason Moon, host of NHPR's Bear Brook podcast, joins me now to talk about this. Hey, Jason.
Good morning, Peter.
Jason, finally hearing the names of the victims, Marlise Honeychurch is the adult mother. Tell us about the others.
The others are Marie Vaughn and Sarah McWaters, and they were Marlise's daughters. And so we knew for a long time that three of the victims were maternally related, and so now we have the names of those three maternally related victims. They were last seen in Southern California in 1978 at a Thanksgiving party with their family, and they were seen there with a man named Terry Rasmussen, who we learned in 2017 was a serial killer that was the most likely suspect in the case. And he died in prison in 2010 while serving a sentence for a separate murder. So we knew the killer, but we didn't know the victims, which was very unusual. And now, today, finally, we know three of the four victims.
Mm-hmm. And tell us how we got to this point. How did whoever figure it out?
Well, it's really kind of an unbelievable coincidence, because what happened was there were two separate investigative tracks that converged at almost exactly the same time. So on the one hand, you had a genetic genealogist named Barbara Ray Venter. She's become a sort of national figure in the last year or so. She was the genealogist who identified the alleged Golden State Killer in California. Before that, she had worked on this case, identified Terry Rasmussen's real name, and had identified the case's connections to a couple of other California cases. She had been responsible for some of the big breakthroughs through this new forensic technique of genetic genealogy. So she had been working on identifying the victims in this case for a long time. And the challenge was getting a DNA sample that was usable, because the victims' remains had been they'd been left out in the elements for so long before they were discovered. But that work finally succeeded last fall, and they were able to get samples that could be put into genealogy databases, and that's how she got the names. Meanwhile, there was a amateur investigator, which you might call a web sleuth, down in Connecticut, who just sort of researched the case in her free time, was looking through thousands of posts of through online forums of where people are looking for missing relatives, and she comes across three names that she thinks might match up, and she ends up submitting a tip to law enforcement literally the same week that Barbara Rae Venter was getting the matches through genealogy. So,
well, can I slow you down for a moment there? Because it's really fascinating to me how the second person sort of went out on her own and triangulated information just on the web, which in theory, if any of us were dedicated enough, we could have done, right?
Exactly. That is, it is sort of an amazing thought to think that those names were sitting out there on the internet for all this time.
So what information did she look for when she was searching these? It was the Ancestry.com forum, right?
That's right. It's a forum where people are looking for relatives that they lost touch with. It's not quite a missing persons forum because they might be missing, but they might just be your family's, you know, moved apart and you're trying to reconnect. So it's kind of this in-between space. And she was looking for people who, you know, posts of people looking for relatives who might match up with what we knew about the victims, like their age ranges. You know, we had rough ideas of where they might have come from. So she spent, you know, just thousands of hours finding posts that could be matches. And then once she had those names, she would look through other records, you know, census records, Facebook, you know, birth and death records, to see if she could find any evidence of those people, you know, post-1985, because that's when the first barrel was discovered. And so if she could find other records of them, she could rule those people out because they were still generating records. They were still alive, most likely. But then she does this over and over and over again, and eventually she finds a post where that's a couple of different families. They're looking for three people, and she can't find any records of them past the late 1970s. And so that's when she starts to get suspicious that could be something.
So it's a huge process of elimination, essentially.
Exactly.
Eliminating,
yeah,
possibilities.
Totally.
And part of the fascinating thing about the Honeychurch disappearance is that it wasn't necessarily a sudden disappearance. It wasn't like, oh, she was expected to be somewhere, and then she wasn't there, and then the police were notified. She just kind of dropped off the radar of her family members for long enough to sort of kind of cast a whole shadow on what may have happened to her, right?
Yeah, it's unfortunately now a kind of familiar story in the Bear Brook murders because it's really similar to the way some of Terry Rasmussen's other victims went missing. It seemed to be sort of part of his MO to separate victims from their families in ways that set up their disappearances not as a missing persons case, but as a they just don't want to hear from you anymore. Mm-hmm. So what we know about Marlise and her family was that they were at a Thanksgiving celebration in 1978. There was some kind of argument between her and her mother, and they left. And so, you know, you might not necessarily think as a family member that she's suddenly missing and you need to call the police, but maybe that, you know, they need some time before you reconnect and what have you. And then time passes, and then all of a sudden you haven't heard from them in many years. And this was a very similar story to what happened to some of Rasmussen's other victims that we knew about before yesterday's press conference.
So because of that, it's really hard, if not impossible, to determine the exact date of their murder?
That's right. So the last time they're seen alive is 1978. And the first barrel is found in 1985. So one question that investigators have is whether, you know, Marlise and her children were even ever alive in New Hampshire. Mm. They might have been murdered prior to and moved here, or they could have moved here and then been murdered. So that's still a bit of a black box among many in the timeline that we have of Terry Rasmussen.
And there's still the fourth unidentified victim.
Right.
What are investigators doing to reveal the identity of that person?
Right. So the fourth unidentified victim is another little girl. She is known to be Terry Rasmussen's biological daughter. So she's the daughter of the murderer in this case. And there is genetic genealogy work that's ongoing to try to identify her. There is a genetic profile that was uploaded to GEDmatch. Unfortunately, that they just weren't able to find any matches that were close enough to start building a family tree. But they're going to try a new database soon called Family Tree DNA that also allows for this kind of searching. and they're still hopeful. So that news could also come, relatively soon. It's hard to say.
At the press conference yesterday, Jeff Srelzin, Associate Attorney General, read a statement from the victims' families.
This day comes with heavy hearts. Marlise, Marie, and Sarah were so loved by our families, and they are greatly missed. We take solace in finally having the answers we have longed for.
So that was Associate Attorney General Jeff Strelzin. Jason Moon, have you spoken with any of the family of the victims?
I did communicate with some of the family online prior to the press conference, but ultimately, as they indicated in their statement, they decided they didn't want to speak publicly about anything at this point.
And so are you getting any rest? You've been here all night, haven't you?
We were up, me and senior producer Taylor Quimby, up till about 5 a.m. getting the latest episode of the Bear Brook podcast out into the world. But certainly it was a long day, and we'll see if there's any more news that breaks today on it.
Well, Jason, the podcast, I listened to as much of it as I could before the program today. It's such a late-breaking episode of this fantastic podcast, and it's super well-produced. Much respect for you and the work you're doing.
Thanks
very much, Jason, for being here. Go get
Anytime.
Some rest.
You bet.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We're speaking about the week's news, and we've got a lot more to talk about. And to talk about it with us, we've got Dave Solomon, reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader, and Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Hey, Peter.
So among the things that happened this week, Governor Chris Sununu nominated Attorney General Gordon McDonald to the New Hampshire Supreme Court. We'll start with you, Dave Solomon. What are your thoughts on this nomination?
Well, it's not entirely surprising. It's clear that the governor thinks very highly of Gordon McDonald, as do many others in the legal community. He was a very accomplished attorney in corporate litigation for many years with the firm Nixon Peabody, having represented defendants in some very high-profile commercial cases involving pharmaceutical companies, involving the disposition of an underwriting fund to protect doctors against malpractice lawsuits in the state. And he's got spectacular conservative Republican credentials. He's been involved with the free market think tank, the Josiah Bartlett Center here in New Hampshire, which has produced a lot of Sununu executives, including his budget director and his chief political advisor, Jamie Burnett. They both come from the Bartlett Center. So he's drawing on that organization almost like President Trump has drawn on the Federalist Society for his judicial appointments. And so he's qualified for the position. It will not be a seamless hearing and confirmation process. The governor will need the vote of at least one of the three Democrats on the executive council, and one of those counselors, Andrew Valinsky, a Democrat and potential candidate for governor, has indicated he has some pretty tough questions he'd like answered.
And we want to get to Valinsky in just a moment, but I do want to, before we move on to those details, I want to hear thoughts from Dean Spiliotis on the nomination.
Jamie. Yeah, I don't think it was a tremendous surprise, but it is a little bit different in the sense that it's not elevating a judge from another part of the state court system, and he is being nominated to go straight from Attorney General to Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Now, here in New Hampshire, I think you have a mandatory retirement at age 70, and the current Chief Justice, Robert Lynn, is retiring in August. So that's a little bit different. But as Dave was saying, he has a long history of legal work in the state, and as Attorney General, just in 2 years, he dealt with a number of high-profile cases. Pretty recently, the online lottery sales, the water contamination issue that's been breaking lately, internet sales tax. There's a whole host of issues that he's been involved on, and generally has been viewed as an effective Attorney General. So, other than a little twist of him going straight from AG to Chief Justice, rather than elevating somebody who's already in a similar position, the pretty reasonable nomination for Sununu. I think it's his third nomination.
Yeah, it is his third. And I wanted to ask you whether or not this is an unusual amount of influence for a governor to have appointed
that's
three
a good
out
question.
Of the five.
I'm not sure Dave might know exactly whether that's unusual or not. I mean, the big difference in New Hampshire, taking sort of a step back, is, you know, you talk about a particular chief executive in the case of the president leaving a mark on the Supreme Court. U.S. Supreme Court has no mandatory retirement age. So you can appoint people who are on the bench for many, many years and leave a lasting mark. With here, with that mandatory retirement age at 70, that changes things a little. It's a little bit different, but still, that's pretty significant.
Dave, what are your thoughts?
Well, having been the attorney general and defended the state's position, at least through his department, in some lawsuits against the state, most recently the one over school funding, he, if confirmed, he'll probably have to recuse himself from some of the biggest cases that might come forward. For instance, should the school funding case that we're going to talk about later involving the towns in the Monadnock area and some others get up to the Supreme Court, that question will come up. Will you recuse yourself from these cases? So he'll be asked about likelihood of recusal in some of these high-profile cases where he may end up sitting as a judge on cases that he has helped, has been involved with as the attorney general. And there's there'll also be questions about the process. Valinsky raised the issue of we want to know, was there a methodical vetting of other applicants? Was there a series of interviews, or did the governor just simply decide he wanted this person and reached out and grabbed him, which is his prerogative, right. But the public has a right to know.
Well, there has been some mention of a list, a bipartisan list of possible nominations, but we don't really know yet what the actual process was.
So any sense that with respect to Andrew Valinsky, that there is some kind of political motivation, that he's trying to raise his profile and for a possible challenge to Governor Sununu?
Well, with the campaign for governor virtually underway, almost anything that Councillor Andrew Valinsky does or State Senator Dan Feltes does, two of them potential Democratic candidates to challenge Sununu, is now cast in the context of their potential candidacy. But they do have roles to perform in their elective offices, and so I don't think we can assume everything is related to their potential
and
run.
Valinsky's concern was, at least what I've heard him mention, is this idea that he's has never been a judge before, that he's going straight from AG to Chief Justice in this case. And but I think I recall that his confirmation AG, I think it was unanimous on the Executive Council, right, which kind of sets him up reasonably nicely for confirmation.
So what would be a reasonable timeline for confirmation in your view?
I think they have public hearings. I think will be pretty soon. Actually, I'm not sure how long until they would have an actual vote. But there has to. I think he was just nominated, obviously, at a meeting, and then there'll be hearings and then a vote. So pretty efficiently would be my guess.
Probably by the end of the month.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. When we come back, NHPR's Sarah Gibson will join us to talk about school funding. Stay with us.
Last fall, we told you the story of a cold case that changed how murders would be investigated forever.
This is the biggest step forward for solving crime since the discovery of DNA itself.
But at the end of that story, the people found in barrels near Bear Brook State Park were still unidentified. I'm Jason Moon. New developments may bring this 30-year mystery to a close soon. Go to nhpr.org for the latest news and subscribe to Bear Brook wherever you get your podcasts.
Monday on the program, we look at biodiversity in New Hampshire in a changing climate. Conservation organizations consider a dire UN report. That's Monday on The Exchange, but right now we're taking a fresh look at the events of the past week on the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and what a week it was. In the studio with me are Dave Solomon, reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, and joining us for this part of the program is NHPR's Sarah Gibson. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you.
So, Sarah, you reported this week that a Cheshire County judge ruled that the state's current formula for funding public schools is unconstitutional. Why did the judge say it's unconstitutional?
So he agreed with the district's claims that the current formula is based on inaccurate numbers, that basically transportation and facilities and teachers cost way more than what the current formula allows for, which is $3,636 per student. He says if you were just to send that amount of money to a school to educate a student, they would be denied an adequate education, which is their constitutional right.
Mm-hmm. And so did the judge spell out the correct amount? Or rather, no, the judge did not do this.
Definitely
right?
not.
But why not? Why didn't the judge decide to say the real amount is this?
That would be a overstep of the court, many would say. And certainly we've had decades now of courts ruling on the unconstitutionality of the state's form of funding schools. They've never said, actually, we think it's $9,000. They haven't given that dollar amount. They've punted it back to lawmakers every time and said, you guys really need to figure this out in a way that is truly constitutional.
So has the legislature decided on an amount that is, in fact, adequate and they're just not, for whatever reason, doing it? Or did they not even know what an adequate amount would be?
From the 100-page ruling, it seems like there has been the ruling documents a history of the lawmakers disagreeing on what that formula should even be. And the charge to lawmakers is really start from scratch. You guys need to figure out what the costs are of an education in New Hampshire and build that into your adequate formula. So I would say lawmakers do not agree on what that is.
Mm-hmm. So how similar is this decision to the decisions made in the 90s, the decisions known as Claremont 1 and Claremont 2?
It certainly echoes them and is in many ways kind of part of that tradition. One thing, though, that it doesn't address is the constitutionality of taxes. So the districts did bring claims that the form of taxation is unconstitutional. That was a similar claim by districts back in the 90s. The judge chose not to really touch that, not to say whether or not it was constitutional.
Mm-hmm. The Senate passed a budget that boosts education funding by $100 million. Senator Jay Kahn said even though this is less than what districts suing the state are asking for, it is a good compromise.
We can't myopically focus just on education without also considering some of the state's other priorities like mental health care and Medicaid reimbursement rates that are adequate.
And worth mentioning, Sarah, that you talked to one legislator who said it may not be a big deal, this ruling. Republican Representative Glenn Cordelli, he disagrees with the court's ruling, and he notes that the legislature is working on the issue.
I don't think this ruling per se will change things much because there was already movement in the legislature to do something. It's just a matter of getting agreement on the total amount.
So, Sarah, is that a fair assessment? It's just a matter of getting agreement on a total amount.
Yeah, but I mean, that's been the argument for decades now. That total amount, what is that? And finally, districts were fed up and they went to court and said, you have had plenty of time to figure that out, that amount. You have yet to do so, lawmakers. So we're suing the state. So, yeah, that amount is still up for debate. Some people will say there's been a major boost in education funding. Some will say it's excessive. Others say it's not enough. These districts were certainly asking for far more than they would receive from the Senate version of the budget.
So what do you make of the Senate budget overall? Is this working for education? Is it a temporary solution? What do you think?
Well, if you look at some of the districts that are struggling the most, they certainly, some of them would get millions more under the new Senate plan. For instance, Franklin would get close to $1 million more. Berlin would get close to $3 million more over the course of 2 years. The district suing could get quite a lot more. But again, it's not nearly as much as districts are saying they deserve in order to, with state funds, pay for an adequate education for their students.
Dean Spiliotis, you wanted to jump in.
Sure. Yeah. As Sarah pointed out, the big issue here is the court correctly said that the decision of what an adequate education is and how you fund it is a legislative question, not a question for the court to decide. And so the judge didn't include any formula or precise definition of an adequate education, simply said, yeah, the 36 isn't enough and it's not adequate. So in some sense, it does feel like we're sort of still in the same place we were now 20 years out from the Claremont decisions, where there's just this big debate over, what is an adequate education? How much does it cost? How do you fund it? What's the impact on property taxes, state aid versus federal aid? This is not going to be, I assume for the litigants, it's nice to have the court weigh in and say, yes, you're correct. But it doesn't solve any of the details. So this is going to be interesting. I mean, the budget, the additional $100 million is one way to move forward. But this is not a settled issue by any means.
Those dollars are only guaranteed as part of the next 2-year budget.
Right.
They don't provide any permanent structural change in education funding that's going to guarantee long-term relief, especially to the public, to the property-poor school districts. And if any legislature can tell you with a straight face that $3,600 per pupil is enough to fund education when the actual costs are anywhere between $14,000 in the poorest districts and $20,000 or more in the wealthier ones, is misinformed.
So it sounds like what you're saying, Dave, is that it didn't take a judge to show that $3,600 was not enough.
I think that's fairly obvious to everyone and has been for years.
Mm-hmm.
But he did point out a couple of things. I mean, I prodded people to say, like, is this actually a big deal? I mean, we have this. It's kind of like a broken record, not only here in New Hampshire, but frankly, throughout the country. I mean, this debate exists about how much do we rely on local property taxpayers to fund education versus the state. So it is perennial. Is this a big deal? I did speak to an attorney who said there is something about this ruling where he actually does name the specific areas that are woefully underfunded by the state, such as transportation, some facilities, definitely teachers. And so I think by naming a couple of things that the adequacy formula definitely leaves out, he says intentionally, that is maybe a little bit of a rubric to revisit the formula. But the formula that the Senate is moving forward, even with, even with their new $100 million, that formula is still intact. And the judge just said that formula is invalid. It's unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm. So given Claremont 1, given Claremont 2, and given this, the length of the time spent on this kind of battle, it may leave some people, especially in property poor districts, feeling kind of hopeless about the way education is funded in the state. Do you see any reason for hope that the legislature is going to figure this out?
Well, I talked to people in the suing districts yesterday, and they said they felt heard. Feeling heard is different than getting money in your wallet. But I do think it adds a little bit of a little sense that of righteousness, maybe, that the thing we've been complaining about and really begging for is the court in fact affirms. But again, it doesn't actually change what dollar amounts these districts could be getting. And right as of now, like, their attorney fees might be paid for, but there's certainly that $1.6 billion is definitely not headed to the southwestern corner of New Hampshire this month.
So as you continue reporting on this, Sarah Gibson, what will you be looking for?
Well, we're still awaiting next steps from the state. I mean, this will probably go up to the state Supreme Court like it has in the past, but we don't quite know yet how they're going to respond. And we're obviously going to look at the debate in the legislature about how much to spend. And they do have in their current budget a desire to put together a new commission to study this formula. So it could be that people really are debating the formula in the next couple of years. I want to say again, debating the formula. That's very different than sending a different amount of money to districts.
Well, Sarah Gibson, we really appreciate your coverage of the debate. Thank you very much for being here today.
You're welcome.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. And since we talked a little bit about the budget, we'll steer the discussion that way. And Dave, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because the New Hampshire Senate passed the $13 billion state budget along party lines late last night. The Democratic-backed plan boosts funding for local schools, as we've said, but it would also increase beds for people in mental health crisis. Your thoughts, generally speaking, Dave, on the budget?
Well, we now officially have three certified versions of the state budget, one that has passed the House, one that has passed the Senate, and one that was presented in February by Governor Sununu, all three with substantial differences. And so it's time for some real serious horse trading in the next couple of weeks to come up with a budget that the House and Senate can both pass, an identical document, and put it on Governor Sununu's desk. And there are things in the Senate budget that the governor says would absolutely trigger a veto, which is the family medical leave program and the 0.5% payroll tax it would implement. There are things in the House budget that the governor says would absolutely trigger a veto, which is a capital gains tax used to significantly boost education funding. He's also opposed to freezing reductions in business taxes that were supposed to take place in 19 and 21. So they're going to have to come to some terms on this, and I think there is a path to a solution in which each side is going to have to give up something to come to a budget the governor can sign. Otherwise, we're looking at a budget veto, a continuing resolution to carry the state agencies through the summer, and ongoing debate over this, which I think all the parties want to avoid, especially coming into an election year.
Dean Spiliotis.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think they're looking to avoid a continuing resolution. We've been we've been down that path before in fairly recent history. At the macro level, these kinds of budget debates, to the extent that they become partisan, and it certainly sounds like there are elements of it that are partisan, really come down always to taxing and spending, to revenue policy and spending policy. And Governor Sununu had said up front that he thought that the 12%+ increase in spending in the budget was too much. Big kind of lines in the sand drawn over the payroll tax for family medical leave, concern about the business tax cuts, I believe, in this budget. They're not rolling them back, but they're stopping the second round of cuts. So, you know, I've heard Republicans in the past say that, well, that's a tax increase. Even though you're just not letting the cut go into effect, you can argue politically that maybe that's a tax increase. So these issues of tax and spending always seem to be where the battle lines are drawn. And I know just from reading some of the coverage of yesterday's session in the Senate, there were a number of amendments by the Republican, maybe Dave can talk about this, from Republicans that were kind of trying to sort of shape the budget a little bit differently, and they kept getting defeated 14-10 along party lines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a considerable effort in the 11th hour on the floor by the Republican caucus to introduce one amendment after the other to eliminate some of the spending programs or tax changes proposed in the budget. They were all beaten back along party lines, and it passed along party lines. When the Democrats were in the minority 2 years ago, they did exactly the same thing, and the outcome was the same. This is basically how the process works. There is broad agreement on issues surrounding mental health funding, around issues surrounding the addressing the crisis of boarding mental health patients in the emergency rooms, around funding the child protective services. There's a large consensus around this. But the issues that both of us alluded to that are contentious are really what are going to be the stumbling blocks.
But Dave, I'm just curious, and we both agree that payroll tax on the family medical leave is going to be problematic for Governor Sununu. What about the not allowing the second round of business tax cuts to go into effect? You think Sununu will argue that that's a tax increase, or will that be a problem for him?
Well, semantics have really become a big part of the debate here. Is the 0.5% payroll deduction for family medical leave an income tax? Is the freezing of the tax cuts a tax increase, or just freezing cut? All of that has been part of the debate. But there's a lot of speculation, but in the end, it may be possible to get a budget there's such a broad consensus about the need to address these mental health, child protection, and emergency room issues that there may be momentum for some parties to give up on some of their cherished elements here. The Democratic Senate may have to let go of the family medical leave plan, which is Dan Feltes's major policy initiative. The House may have to give up on the capital gains tax. The governor may have to accept the freezing of the business tax cuts. And then we could have a bargain.
You just solved the problem there. Dave just figured it out for everyone.
We're solving problems here on the Roundup. This is NHPR. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. This week, Governor Sununu vetoed a House bill that would have increased the cap on net metering from 1 megawatt to 5. Dave Solomon, union leader, reported on this. Why did the governor say he wanted to veto this one?
This question of net metering has been a point of contention between the governor and a bipartisan coalition in the House, actually. There's support for this net metering program among Republicans and Democrats. Jeb Bradley in the Senate, one of the leading Republicans in the Senate, being a major champion. It's a way to encourage the development of solar energy by allowing the owners of solar panels to sell the excess energy they generate back into the grid, which the utilities would be fine with if they only had to pay the same wholesale price for that energy that they pay the owner of a power plant. But in order to foster renewable energy, the program calls for the utilities to pay more than the wholesale price. And that is viewed as a subsidy that then gets passed along to the other ratepayers to support the development of solar.
Yeah, this is something that goes back to really to Governor Sununu's first run for governor. And when he came into office, he made a pretty big change in the overarching focus of energy policy. He basically said that Democrats are too focused on percentage of energy from renewable sources, that the goal is always about, 60% renewable by this year, 70% renewable 10 years later, et cetera. He said he was going to shift and focus on the cost of electricity and power to consumers. It's going to be about the price. Not that renewables are good, but they're not an end in themselves. You have to focus on the cost. And so this whole net metering issue to increase solar fits into that, where he's basically arguing that the power sold back to the grid, the excess solar power, is too expensive, and that is passed on to the consumers, that the consumers are basically stuck subsidizing something that can't function at a market rate. So this has been a noticeable shift in terms of energy policy at the state level.
Well, the counterargument is that the impact on consumer bills for that fraction of a difference in the price that the utility has to pay for the small number of solar installations that exist is very small, hardly noticeable, in fact, and that what it's doing is promoting a form of energy that in the long term reduce costs by reducing transmission costs, because you're generating more energy locally. You don't have to build large transmission infrastructure to deliver, and it's just a wiser way to create a better fuel mix so that renewables become a better part of the state's energy mix and we're not so reliant on fossil fuels.
The other kind of interesting point or caveat I would throw in there, just in kind of watching the solar debate develop, it's starting to feel a little bit to me like some of the issues with wind power. As companies come in and try to establish these larger commercial solar arrays in different towns, all kinds of zoning issues and debates are popping up, just like they did with the wind farms. And so I think that, you can read about in Concord and elsewhere, there have been big issues about, how much coverage can you have of the land and how big can it be, and neighbors have issues. And so you get, the renewables often come with these larger issues of zoning and adapting current property use to a new technology.
Sure. Yeah. Industrial scale renewables may be better in terms of mitigating global warming, but they're not visually attractive. You're still going to you're dealing with industrial sized infrastructure.
Yeah.
Also in the news this week, the New Hampshire Supreme Court is expected to decide whether a prep school graduate convicted of sexual assault deserves a new trial over ineffective counsel. 23-year-old Owen LaBrie was found guilty for the assault of a 15-year-old classmate in 2015. The act was part of a senior game of sexual conquest at St. Paul's School. The state Supreme Court upheld LaBrie's convictions last year, and it's scheduled to rule on ineffective counsel appeal today. Also, the Monadnock region's first syringe exchange program is getting off the ground later this month. The Keene Serenity Center is sending out recovery coaches to give homeless people kits with syringes, disposable bags, and safe injection instructions. Also from the State House this week, a bill to raise New Hampshire's minimum wage to $12 an hour by 2022 passed the legislature. Dave, Governor Sununu expected to veto this one?
I think so. First of all, the House and the Senate are going to have to reconcile their differences. The Senate, they both agree that the minimum wage should go from $7.25 to $10 to $12 over the next 3 years. But where they disagree is the Senate bill gives employers the option of an exemption from these increases if they offer a certain number of paid sick days, trying to trade higher wages for better benefits, whereas the House bill does not contain such an exemption. They just want the wage to go up, period. There will be some compromise because the Democrats want to put a minimum wage bill on the governor's desk. They're going to put a lot of bills on his desk that they know he's going to veto and plan to run against that in November.
Mm-hmm. They're also out of the legislature this week, the effort by State House Democrats to roll back a series of Republican-backed voting rights reforms. It moved ahead yesterday. This bill would reverse a new law that ends the state's distinction between domicile and residency for voting. It's been a heated partisan fight. Dave, yet another veto coming for this one?
These are pretty sure vetoes on the back and forth on the election law bills. They're Democrat bills that have been passed through the House and Senate and will inevitably end up on Sununu's desk. One of them would roll back the Republican-passed legislation tightening up on the definitions of residency and requiring people to comply with motor vehicle registration and licensing requirements if they vote. And the other one would roll back a bill that Republicans passed that established new procedure for voter verification if you're trying to register on election day or within 30 days of the election. So those will pass, and they'll get vetoed. And there are not the numbers to override those vetoes. So it's unlikely that the governor's veto on minimum wage or the election law rollbacks will be overridden. We'll have to see.
Worth mentioning before we head into a break that minutes ago we did hear that the New Hampshire Supreme Court denied Owen LaBrie's request for a new trial, which he had requested. He and his lawyer said he had deserved one over ineffective counsel, but the state Supreme Court has denied that request. Yeah. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. And still to come, the Mount Washington Observatory is suing the Cog Railway over payments it says are due. We will look at the details of the lawsuit as we round up an exciting week of news here in New Hampshire. Stay with us. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Recently on The Exchange, transgender panelists answer a listener's question about how to talk about those times before their child transitioned.
Just because they've come out as trans does not lessen that experience. You still own those memories. And I would say to any parent, those memories are yours of your child. It's just being thoughtful both to what you need as a parent and understanding that your first priority is to make sure that your child is loved.
The Exchange is your place for New Hampshire conversations. Weekday mornings at 9, only on NHPR.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dave Solomon, reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. And joining us for this part of the program is Charlie Jordan, editor of the Colebrook Chronicle. Charlie, welcome to the Roundup.
Oh, glad to be here, Peter.
Charlie, wanted to ask you all about the lawsuit filed the Mount Washington Observatory filed against the Cog Railway. We learned that they're going to be actually taking each other to court. This conflict goes back about a decade. Can you tell us a little bit about what the fight's about?
Yeah, I mean, this is like an ongoing spat between the Cog and, some of the other forces on the top of Mount Washington. What this lawsuit that was brought in into Superior Court here in Coos County on Monday was all about was that the Mount Washington Observatory is saying that the Cog Railway has breached an agreement that they had with the observatory and the auto road to supply supplemental funds to help pay for the new museum that was put on there. I was up there last year. It's really a nice museum. They retooled it to call it the Extreme Mount Washington Museum up there.
My understanding is that they had been paying, but they stopped.
Yeah,
right?
They were paying. I guess this was an agreement that they put together in 2009, and it was the past 2 years. I think it was like 16 or 17 or 18, something like that, that they stopped paying for 2 years, a period of 2 years. What the agreement was that every passenger who came up on the Cog was allowed free access to the museum, and in turn, the Cog would pay a dollar for each one of those people. And so there are about 100,000 people that go up on the Cog every year. So they're looking for $200,000 to help fund this $1 million project. Now, why it stopped 2 years ago, that's the big question. But there has been some really, shall we say, bad blood, I guess, between what Wayne Presby has proposed up there.
Wayne Presby being the owner of the
Cog? He's the owner of the Cog Railway. He proposed in 2016 a 35-room luxury hotel, which was going to be built near the tracks of the Cog. And that was met with a lot of opposition from environmentalists who saw that as, you know, something might endanger the alpine, fragile alpine terrain of Mount Washington. Now, Presby looks back at a period of time from the 19th century when tourism was a big part, you know, overnight guests at the top of Mount Washington. P.T. Barnum, President Grant's family, others would stay at the Summit House Hotel up there. And it was a very lucrative kind of existence. That ended in 1908 when they had a large fire that burned the Summit House. And they've never really gone back to that until Wayne has brought forward an 1894 agreement that the COG was really the only entity that has a right to have lodging and food served on the top. Now, this, again, flies in kind of the face of what the Sherman Adams building is doing up there. So all of a sudden, I mean, I'm reading a little bit into this, but you can see where when that opposition surfaced, things went south fast.
Mm-hmm. And so the COG says they're planning to sue. Have they actually filed suit yet?
They have not filed back. I'm not sure exactly what they're countersuing other than it may be along the lines, again, of this particular understanding of an agreement, which the observatory, you know, they feel actually the terminology of the suit is such that they say that there have been, quote, false claims of land ownership and other supposed restrictive covenants. And they term that as harassment. So they feel they've been being harassed in the public by the COG Railway. Now here, the COG Railway, you know, this year is marking its 150th anniversary. So you've got that, you've got the auto road, and you've got the observatory going all up there. And then when you step back and think about it, it's, you know, they're battling over the rock pile, really. But it's such an important part of our state.
It's a beloved rock pile.
It sure is. And everybody wants a little piece of it. You know, just really quickly, it reminds me of a story about a fellow named Nazaro, who in the 1850s set up a toll booth on Mount Washington and tried to get a dollar from everyone going up. Well, he was kind of like run out of town. He came back in the 1870s and tried to collect money from the Tip Top House and the Summit House, and that didn't work either. But, you know, again, sort of like taking squatters' rights on the top of Mount Washington. I'm not saying that that's what the COG is doing, but there's been a long battle for ownership on that very priceless piece of property.
Well, as summer tourism season becomes a thing this year, are visitors going to notice any signs of this conflict, or is it just going to be sort of a happy experience for visitors?
Gee, I don't really know. I mean, I went up to the summit last year, and everything seemed kind of, you know, wonderful. And, I mean, the line of the people who, it's amazing. It's like a Disney line of people wanting to stand at that pole where you're at the highest point, you know. And it doesn't seem to, excuse me, have affected that at all. But, you know, you never know. I mean, somebody may just say, well, you know, okay, we're going to stop doing this or start doing that. So it's a battle that's going to have to play out, and I have no idea how it's going to, you know, result here, except it just seems to be getting deeper as we get further along here, very many layered. Now, you know, the COG has not filed yet with the Coos County Planning Board a site plan. So where is that going to go? I think that would be the next step, you know, is that the site plan, again, for this particular Summit Hotel, which, you know, as I say, has been met with quite a bit of opposition from environmentalists.
Charlie, stay with us. I have some other news that I want to talk about our entire panel, including the visit of Joe Biden this week.
Sure, I was there on Tuesday, yep.
So there, and when you say there, did you see his North Country stop, or were you all over the place with him?
Well, actually, you know, it was so funny because, you know, he announced his first state visit a couple of weeks ago, and he went to Hampton, and he went to Manchester Community College, and I think he ended up in Nashua that day. And I thought, okay, this is going to be months before we see him up in Coos County. So I went all the way down and covered the Manchester appearance. And then lo and behold, he announces his second tour, and it starts right here in Coos County at the Berlin City Hall on Tuesday. So we went down again and covered it. This time we kind of used it, instead of having two front page stories about Joe Biden to look kind of like we're biased or something, we this week did a front page story about who has actually come to Coos County at this point. And about half of the 23 Democrats have actually set foot in our county so far. So they're discovering the North, you know. But Biden was there on Tuesday and had quite an entourage with him.
Yeah, and he was speaking a little bit about climate change. Dean, I want to pull you into this part of the conversation. What was Joe Biden saying about his climate change policy?
It's interesting. There was a little bit of controversy because some of the planks in his plan were apparently lifted or plagiarized, if you will, from another plan. We don't know that he did it, but perhaps some staffer or whoever was putting together the nuts and bolts of the climate change plan. And the kind of the bigger picture on Joe Biden is the conventional wisdom, and I think it's generally correct, is that he's been running a general election campaign. He's double digits ahead of the next closest candidate, Bernie Sanders. It dropped a little bit, but not all that much since his high point in the mid-30s in terms of polling. And so, you know, he's basically kind of doing his own thing and avoiding engaging with the other candidates whenever possible. And you're starting to see the candidates who are stacked below him, whether it's Elizabeth Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, all kind of indirectly suggesting that, you know, that this sort of hyper-focus on electability and kind of a general election strategy, that that's not really good for the party, that they need to have more of a progressive debate about big ideas and moving forward. So I think his attempt to introduce a climate change plan is part of that in response. And then also yesterday there was a controversy over the Hyde Amendment, which is a federal amendment that bans federal funding of abortion. He had previously supported that ban. He's been getting a lot of pushback from other candidates. And yesterday he announced he read a statement saying that he had changed his mind and that he would no longer support a ban on federal funding. So whether he likes it or not, he's slowly getting drawn into the larger debate with the other candidates. But as much as possible, he's just kind of trying to do his own thing. He was here in Concord at a local union hall, had a good turnout. That's the question. There's a group of progressives in the party, a lot of activists who want to have a debate about progressive policy. There are others who are kind of hyper-focused on electability. So Biden's challenge is to show that he can talk policy. The progressives' challenge is to show that they can talk electability.
Mm-hmm. And Charlie, I wanted to ask you about what Joe Biden said about impeachment of President Trump. It seems like the candidates, all of them are being asked whether or not they would support that. And Joe Biden said no. He said he'd rather oust President Trump the old-fashioned way through an election. What was your sense of what he had to say about that?
It was interesting because, I mean, you know, I've since heard Nancy Pelosi almost say the same thing. I don't know if Biden started this or what, but, you know, he made a point of saying during his Berlin speech that he would not talk about the current president while he was not in the United States. Of course, at that point, Trump was in England. But, you know, he certainly talked all around the issues. It seems to me that, I mean, he didn't come out specifically on that. It was funny because I think it was CNN. I was standing beside them when they got a question to him about him not being in California, you know, at the Democratic thing out there. And his response was, I'll see ya. I mean, he said that twice. And basically, he'll be getting into that mix soon enough. So, but, you know, the key thing I got out of the Berlin thing was, you know, he was light on specifics. He would say, well, I'm not going to burden you with all the details. Go to my website. But his big thing is just saying he wants to bring back, I mean, again, these are his words, you know, decency and respect to politics. Good luck with that, you know. But he really, one of the funny things that I've seen now that I've seen him twice at length, he should write a book about sayings of my father, because he often says, as my dad said, and this time he mixed it up and said, as my mother always said. But again, it's that homey kind of approach that he's trying to connect with the audience. And, you know, he had all age groups in that room, and, you know, a lot of people were just sizing him up, as we do in New Hampshire, you know.
Mm-hmm. Also in the news this week, a new system to serve the health needs of veterans took effect yesterday. It's called the VA Mission Act. This law ends the program known as Veterans Choice, which aimed to create health care options for veterans in the private sector but was bogged down with bureaucratic problems. The Mission Act aims to correct that with the new Veterans Community Care Program, and it also offers a new urgent care benefit. Also, Manchester Airport is again offering direct flights to Chicago's O'Hare. Airport Director Theodore Kitchen says the new connection will help bolster business and tourism in New Hampshire. And an uplifting story, an animal story written in the Union, New Hampshire Union Leader this week. A Sugar Hill police officer helped a homeowner remove a duck stuck in a chimney. An unusual sound was coming from the chimney. It prompted a call to the police from the homeowner. Officer Derek Sullivan opened the chimney, cleaned out. Lo and behold, there's a duck in there. The police got the duck out, brought the duck to a pond. All ended well. And why not another animal story I'll ask you about, Charlie? There was a baby moose found wandering in Colebrook, seemingly without its mother. What happened with that moose?
Well, you know, it's funny. It brings up a point. You know, we look at the Complete Police blog every week, and people think about the spectacular news about arrests and whatever. But, you know, law enforcement has to deal with everything. And last week, a call went to the Colebrook Police Department that a baby moose was wandering around on Route 145 right at the height of a tourist weekend near Beaverbrook Falls. And I just happened to be driving by when I saw this. I was wondering what was going on. I saw these groups of people gathered around what I thought was a German Shepherd. And it was a baby moose, and it was wailing, and it had gotten separated from its mother. And, you know, people were concerned about it roaming into the road. So eventually Officer Dakota Lurvey from the Colebrook Police Department came down and sort of stood guard until Fish and Game could get there. You know, it's these things, I guess, increasingly are happening because of the moose population diminishing. I was talking with a conservation officer last night, and they were saying that because of the survival mode of the mothers, often they feel like they can't, you know, support a child, and the child just roams away, you know. And this particular baby moose, which was about a week old, still had its umbilical cord on it and was roaming around. And what the outcome of the story, I don't know what became of the moose. We're all hoping for the best, but there's a place in Madison, I guess, it's the name of it's Elaine Connors Center for Wildlife, and they take everything from birds, moose, whatever, raccoons, and try to, you know, get them through those early stages until they can be released in the wild again. But it was quite a thing, you know, to watch this poor little thing roaming around, wailing. But a lot of people were looking out for it. But there's also a lesson to not get too close to these because sometimes they will roam back out in the wilds by themselves.
Yeah, and if the mother is nearby, look out.
Yeah.
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 Well, we're going to put a photo of the baby moose from the Colebrook Chronicle on our website so you can check it out there. Charlie Jordan, thanks very much for being on the Roundup today. We really appreciate
it. Fun talking with you. I love your program.
Thank you. Come on back sometime.
All right, will do.
And thanks also to Dave Solomon, reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader, Dean Spiliota, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you.
And remember, the conversation about all the stories we talked about today continues online at nhpr.org as well as on Facebook. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our public radio fellow is Ali Oshinsky, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. It's going to be a sunny weekend. I hope you enjoy it.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.